Christina Martini and Rich Linkoff. You know what time it is. Welcome to Legal Face Off. Two lawyers trading jab for jab. So hit them up with any questions you have.
Welcome into Legal Face Off. Rich Linkoff, Tina Martini. The Legal Eagles are here. The first episode of August. Ben Anderson is behind the glass, and my name is Sam Panionovich. We'll talk impeachment. We'll talk election tampering. Little gun legislation inside out. David Sussler back in the house and then the grab bag at the end of the show. But we begin with Congressman Mike Quigley from the 5th District. He got elected in April 2009, but he's been in public office for 30 years now, and he joins us now in the studio, in the House. Congressman, welcome to the show.
Glad to be here. Thank you.
So you recently wrote in a Chicago Tribune op-ed piece that Trump should be, or we should, you should begin impeachment proceedings now against Trump, not wait till he's out of office. Tell us why you feel that way.
About 5 minutes before my questions for Director Mueller, the old criminal defense attorney in me started to raise another issue. Let's do the math. Statute of limitations on obstruction of justice is 5 years. If a president serves 2 terms, he can serve past the statute of limitations. So it occurred to me as we look at the Justice Department's determination, its policy, that a seated president can't be indicted. It's hard for me to imagine that our founding fathers wanted to create a situation in which a seated president could be above the law. So the alternative is either you alter the Justice Department regulations or you open an impeachment inquiry, as was the beginning of the Watergate hearings. And I think it does several things. It spells out the crimes and misdemeanors we're talking about. It elongates what the Mueller testimony was all about into a protracted period of time to educate and inform the American people so we know exactly what we're addressing. And I think it gives you additional leverage with courts to try to get the information we've been seeking for a long time about this president.
So you think it sounds like it's an interesting legal theory because it sounds like you're saying you don't necessarily have to decide right now whether Trump committed the requisite high crimes and misdemeanors to successfully prosecute him, but rather impeachment proceedings are a means of discovery, of a means of finding out a little more detail as to what happens. Of course, opponents of that will say there's been, including the president, will say there's been enough. There's been, you know, House and a ton of investigations already. But it sounds like you're saying that this is a means of finding out a little more detail legally as to what might have transpired.
Well, several things. It's clear that 3% of the American people had read the Mueller report before that hearing. About 14 million people watched that. Watergate was a prolonged experience where we learned a lot. It was sort of an oh-by-the-way moment that we learned that there were secret tapings in the Oval Office, which led to, obviously, Richard Nixon's downfall. As important as everything that's in the report is what's not in the report. It should be abundantly clear that special counsel did not look at following the money. I was in Cyprus over a year ago following the money laundering issues. It is clear that the director didn't do any of those things. It's also clear that the counterintelligence investigation, which is where this all began, was handed off to other entities. We clearly don't know who that is. So these hearings could also bring people like the FBI director to ask fair questions. Was the president of the United States compromised? And what do we know at this point?
Well, you had asked him specifically whether if a president was still in office when the statute of limitations ran, what would happen? And he didn't answer the question. What is your takeaway from that?
I think my takeaway is they hadn't thought about it. And I'm not sure the people at the Justice Department have thought about it. This is a policy, I think, that was put in place around 1969, and it's been continued on a bipartisan basis. I get the notion of the policy. I don't know if it stands up based on concerns about the statute of limitations and our hyper-partisan world we're living in which I'm not sure what the president has to be accused of for this Senate to move forward on impeachment. And that's a little concerning. And for those who say, oh, you know, we've had this investigation, read the report. It is very clear that the director was putting this in Congress's hands. I believe he is of a notion that the president of the United States obstructed justice. He gave us 10 pretty clear examples. it is obvious the American public needs to be further informed about what took place there and what's missing from the Director Mueller's investigation.
Congressman, just yesterday, the House Judiciary Committee sued to force former White House counsel Don McGahn to testify before Congress, asking a federal judge to strike down the Trump administration's claim that presidential aides like McGahn are absolutely immune from its subpoenas. Do you think this lawsuit will be successful?
It should. You mentioned earlier that the investigations have gone on for some time. I was part of the House Intel investigation from the first day. I will tell you, this isn't the first example of the White House squashing the testimony of key witnesses as to obstruction and other violations. We haven't been able to get to the truth. It will require the courts to force that issue. McGahn is as critical a witness as anyone. If you read the report, it's pretty clear that if he hadn't pushed back on the president would have fired Mueller. The president would have put out false information to the press about his efforts to fire Mueller. And he was a witness to the firings and all the information we gleaned about General Flynn and the firing of Director Comey.
And in many ways, I mean, the lawsuit in and of itself is an example of obstruction. I mean, if you're not afraid of what McGahn has to say, and if he didn't actually do the things that people allege that he did and step in and prevent Trump from firing, you know, doing what he wanted to do, then let him speak. But the very fact that he's filing a lawsuit, doesn't that just support the idea that Trump is obstructing justice?
I think it does. I think that one of the places that the president fails is the court of karma. For those of us who can remember the Republican convention where General Flynn and others were leading chants of lock her up, they were also mocking people who took the Fifth Amendment, people who pled immunity, people who thought the president of the United States had widespread abilities to not let people testify. They're doing anything that took place there times a much higher factor.
So turning now to the horrific shootings this past weekend in El Paso and in Dayton, what can you and your fellow legislators do to try to help solve this epidemic?
I think the House has begun this. The fact that we're in the majority was, I think, a good first step because we have passed a couple bills, the first since I've been there, and one of them dealt with background checks. I was in the Supreme Court watching the arguments about Chicago's gun case. This is where this all started, the Second Amendment. And in there, it's instructive to read the opinion of the majority. And while they said there is a Second Amendment right, they were astute enough and I think fair enough to say that's like all rights, not unlimited. And the language is valuable about where Congress needs to go. Basically, it says that doesn't mean anybody can get a gun and they can have any kind of gun they want anywhere they want. So the vast majority of Americans, vast majority of NRA members don't want bad people to get guns. They favor universal background checks. And they recognize what I think common sense tells us all. When you have an assault weapon and you have 100 rounds in the magazine, you're not defending your home. You're not hunting deer. You're hunting people. And that's one of the limits I think the Supreme Court was talking about and something Congress should act on immediately.
That is the Congressman Mike Quigley from the 5th District. He's been in since April 2009. I have to ask you one last question. It's the prime of 16-inch season, so let me lob one up for you. No Joel Quenneville anymore, but Colleton now gets a full season. You're a diehard Blackhawks fan. What do you think the ceiling is this year? You got Taves and Kane, Crawford back. What do you think?
I think it helps to have another goaltender with experience who fought for the Vezina last year. They're 2 years out of being in the playoffs. I know they're particularly hungry. Every season's different in hockey. I think as important as all that is, these players are now going to have some experience with the new coach and his brand new system and a training camp to learn about that. And defensemen like Seabrook have a little more time to adjust to it, because for a person his age and size, it's a different game.
Certainly is. That's Mike Quigley, Congressman from the 5th District. Thank you so much for coming in. Really appreciate it.
Anytime. Thank you.
Rich Lenkoff is an insurance defense attorney with Bryce Downey & Lenkoff. Rich is consistently recognized by clients for his outstanding litigation results. In 2015, Target named him their top outside litigation attorney in the country. Rich has received a number of industry accolades, including Illinois Super Lawyer from 2015 through 2018 and Leading Lawyer from 2012 through 2018, designations given to less than 5% of Illinois attorneys. Rich is also an active member of his community, including serving on the Lincoln Park High School Local School Council, the Advisory Board of Legal Prep Charter Academy, and the Board of Visitors for the Northern Illinois University College of Law. In addition to his full-time legal practice, Rich is a producer with credits, including 85, The Greatest Team in Football History, starring former President Barack Obama, Bill Murray, and Mike Ditka, and Renegades, a live show production at Caesars Palace in Las Vegas, starring Terrell Owens, Jose Canseco, and Jim McMahon. In addition to co-hosting Legal Faceoff since 2013, Rich is the legal analyst for several WGN shows, including The Bill and Wendy Show and Patty Vasquez with Andrea Darlis. Bryce Downey & Lenkoff is a full-service litigation firm practicing general liability, workers' compensation, professional liability, business transactions, construction law, and intellectual property. For more information about Rich and Bryce Downey & Lenkoff, please visit bdlfirm.com.
Welcome back to Legal Faceoff. You can like the show on Facebook. You can follow us on Twitter, and you can always find us on iTunes, Apple Music, wherever you consume your podcast. You can rate, review, and listen to the show. Joining us now on the line, she's a state rep in her fourth term from the 77th District, the website repwillis77.com. The Democratic rep, Kathleen Willis, joining us now. Representative, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Appreciate being on.
So, Representative, we're still all reeling from the horrific weekend of mass shootings in El Paso and Dayton. One of your passions is gun control, and you were the sponsor of the recently enacted red flag gun law, which went into effect in Illinois on January 1st of this year. You're also the sponsor of Senate Bill 1966, which is known as the Fix the Floyd Act. Can you please walk us through the red flag law as well as the bill that's currently under consideration?
Sure. Well, I'm so proud that Illinois took the initiative and is one of, we have about 8 states that have red flag laws in it. And what it does is it is a proactive bill that allows family members that see those warning signs from their significant others and their loved ones that they probably should not have a gun readily available to them, access to that gun. They are lawful gun owners. They have not done anything yet illegal. They haven't been arrested, so there's no statutory prohibitors, but there are things that show warning signs. They might be in a very distressed state, maybe going through a divorce, where and drinking more than normal, showing very open anger situations, maybe doing some veiled threats. Those things that someone says, you know, I don't think it's a good idea for you to have a gun. So they then have an opportunity to file before a judge and have a temporary order where those guns are taken out of the home. FOID card is temporarily suspended till the person gets their life back in order. The end of that term, a person has a chance to defend themselves in court, but at the end of the 6-month period of time, and that's what the temporary order goes for, they can prove that their life's back in order. They get their guns back, no harm, no foul. And they are continue again to be lawful gun owners.
Representative, I think sorry to cut you off. I think the red flag laws are strong, and I think they're, you know, a really good step forward. However, in the shootings that we saw in Dayton and El Paso, there were warning signs. We're hearing more as the investigation continues. But here in Illinois, in Aurora, Illinois, we all are familiar with the shooting that happened back in February of 2019, just a few weeks after the law that you co-sponsored went into effect. And in that case, the Aurora, Illinois disgruntled employee who we know shot, I think, 6 and killed 6 of his coworkers. This was after he had exhibited many signs. In fact, he had told coworkers that if he got fired, he was going to come back and blow up the police, I think he said, and he was going to kill some coworkers. why didn't the law work then? Obviously, it's not a panacea and it's not going to fix every problem, but it sure would have been nice for the red flag law to work in that situation.
It would have tremendously. And I think part of that, when we go back into it, I don't think the person closest to him was his mother, and she didn't even know that he had a firearm anymore. And that was part of it. I think she had said if she knew that he had a gun, she would have gone and taken steps to make sure that gun was no longer there. So that's part of the situation. But directly as a result of Aurora brought us to the next piece of legislation I'm working on, which is to fix the FOID. We know that the shooter in Aurora should not have had a gun. His FOID card had been revoked, but nobody did follow through to make sure that he had turned in any guns that he may have owned. And that's what we came through with what is called Senate Bill 1966, which is the Fix the FOID Act. Puts in place some safeguards, making sure that nobody drops the ball in the process of making sure that when a FOID card needs to be revoked, appropriate action is taking place. The most important part is we're trying to cut down on the number of revocations that come about every year. We have 10,000 revocations. We want to bring that down to a much more manageable number by stopping people at the front end. Fingerprinting, that's what we put in there. Fingerprinting is what actually caused the revocation for the Aurora shooter, because we saw through a fingerprint search that he actually had a record that made him a prohibited gun owner.
What are the current requirements for a FOID application, and where do background checks fit into it, if at all?
So a background check is done. It's done through a state database and a national database, but it's only as good as the information that's put into it. You do not currently have to. You fill out a one-page form that says, do you have a felony? Give us your name and your date of birth, and that's what they search under. And it doesn't always give you all of the information. If you have a common last name, if you changed your name, if you put false information down, there's no way of knowing for sure. Fingerprints don't lie. If we do a search under a fingerprint, we're not going to get false information.
So address, if you can, some of the opposition to both of these pieces of legislation, because with regards to red flag law, people have said that that does not afford people due process because you're almost assumed guilty without, again, the benefit of due process. And then the FOID Act, or Fix the FOID Act, opponents have said, among other things, that it treats minorities or disproportionately impacts minorities because of the higher FOID fees. Personally, I don't understand how a $10, you know, increase in fees would dramatically affect anyone who could afford to buy a gun and keep it. But what have you said to opponents in response to these two pieces of legislation?
Well, when we finalized, we did a lot of negotiation on the red flag law, and we made sure that it did follow due process. We put in protections against false claims, making sure that that would protect the person from false claims, especially in cases of hostile divorces. And we did not want it to be used in those situations. So we made very conscious effort and made it a very tight law to do that. So that's that part. The other, with the increased charge for the FOID cards, we needed to do that in order to give the state police the money and the ability to do all of the work we want them to do, to give them the resources. Again, we also made sure that we brought it up minimally. It's been $10 for a 10-year card since it was inception in the 1960s. We need to bring it up to where it needs to be cost-wise, going up to $20 for a 5-year card. We put a cap in on the amount that someone could charge for fingerprints. We tried to make it as reasonably priced as possible. I also feel if you can afford a gun and you can afford your bullets, you can afford what it takes to be a lawful gun owner. You pay for your driver's license, it's $30, $35 for a 4-year license. This is going to be less than that. And you only need to fingerprint once. Once it's on file, you don't have to redo it.
Representative, we know how much pressure organizations like the National Rifle Association exerts nationwide, but specifically in Washington. That's, you know, mostly why we're not seeing any significant action, even in the wake of these shootings, on gun control and gun reform. I'm curious, from your perspective here in Illinois, how much of that pressure do you feel? There are obviously some local and state organizations that advocate on behalf of gun owners, but how much pressure do you feel, and how do you overcome those lobbying efforts to avoid significant gun control legislation?
Well, I think, you know, they like to do doomsday scenarios and worst case scenarios, and that's where the gun lobby, they live off of putting in fear to people that, you know, we have to have our guns because we have to override the government when they take over, things like that. That is not the case. I think if we can take the common sense gun legislation, I have nothing against gun owners. I have family members that are gun owners. I have family members that are FOID card holders. I don't have a problem with lawful gun owners. And anybody that's a lawful gun owner should not have a problem with any of the legislation I pull through. I am not trying to confiscate guns. I'm just trying to make sure that we keep certain guns and guns out of the wrong people's hands, because that's what we need to see. And we need to take a proactive stance, because I am sick and tired of standing up on the House floor, offering prayers, and with nothing to follow up with that we can stop it from happening again.
So to that point, you have support here in Illinois because, you know, the Dems are in power, and you've got a newly elected Democratic governor in Pritzker who's got, you know, still a lot of coattails from the election. Nationally, of course, you have Trump, who is not helping your cause very much. How do you deal with the sentiment coming out of the White House?
Well, all I can do is stand strong. Doing nothing is not an option for me. I have met so many survivors of gun violence, family members that have lost loved ones to this, family members that have been wounded by drive-by shootings. I cannot ignore their pain, and I need to continue this fight, and I will do that.
She is Illinois State Representative Kathleen Willis from the 77th District. RepWillis77.com. Representative, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you. Have a great afternoon.
We all know the legal world is complex and high-pressured. There's no room for error. That's why judges and attorneys across Chicagoland have trusted the expert court reporters at McCorkle Litigation Services since 1948. McCorkle Litigation Services has accurately recorded every word from thousands of legal proceedings. McCorkle Litigation Services provides the legal community with peace of mind, transcribing testimony and depositions that can be used reliably by jurors, judges, and attorneys. For all of your legal support needs, contact McCorkle Litigation Services online at McCorkleLitigation.com.
Final segment of the show before we get to the legal grab bag. It's Inside Out, and it's always a treat when David Sussler is in the house. You know him as the better half of Inside Out, not of the household.
Hey.
He's the Associate General Counsel of National Material LP. Is that okay? Are you the better half of Inside Out?
I am the in-house side of Inside Out.
Ah, okay. All right. So the final or the last episode, July 2019, Create Creativity. Interesting. Where should we start, Tina?
Yeah, I mean, Sistine, listen, we're lawyers, right? We do sometimes very boring things and not very creative. How could you write an article about lawyers needing to be creative? I thought we're the opposite of that.
It's a suggestion to lawyers to be creative.
Tell me about it. Why? Why should lawyers be creative?
Lawyers need to be creative because that's what clients are looking for, and it's a way for lawyers to distinguish and differentiate themselves from other people. It's a very new landscape, this legal practice of ours over the past 10 years, and it's a really flat demand, and so it's all about differentiating yourself and stealing market share from somebody else, at least when you're outside counsel like I am and you are, Rich. And so it's important to figure out ways to be more valuable to your clients and being creative and not just looking at the legal solution, but looking at it in the context of the client's business and trying to get to yes for them whenever you can, even if it doesn't look like a great situation. Helping them navigate to at least getting as close to where they want to be as possible is important.
All right, David, you hire outside counsel. Two outside counsel are coming to you. They want to get your business. They want you to hire them. They're both equally qualified in terms of you know, knowing what you do and what you need done, why do you hire the more creative person? And how do you even figure out who the more creative person is?
Well, sure. And I've got some examples from actual things I've gone through. Like when I'm looking for outside counsel in a matter and I don't know them, and I go to, I remember a large firm many years ago, and I said, well, what do you think about this case? Well, we can do this. We do this all the time. Well, knowing what you know now, what do you think? Well, we'll have to study it more. And I went to another firm, which actually at the time was Tina's firm. And they said, well, knowing what we know now, here are three ideas that I would run with. And I've already got some ideas. And so they're showing me thoughtfulness and creativity right on the spot. That's how they demonstrate creativity. And I'm saying, I'm going to go with them because they're willing to think on their feet. And that's really important to me.
Tina, how do you show your clients that you're thinking outside the box, for lack of a better term, or to use a cliche? But that's what we're talking about here. We're trying to show our clients that we are not just run-of-the-mill, you know, cookie-cutter lawyers, that we are different and we are creative and we, to your point, can produce different solutions to their problems. Often, you know, that are also coupled with keeping costs in line and, you know, providing value. So you've got to, you know, temper a lot of different goals here. How do you show your clients that you're being creative?
It depends, as you mentioned, Rich, on what the client's different levers are, what kind of budget they have, what their risk tolerance is, how in the event that something goes off the rails, what like changeover costs and PR considerations are going to be. And so what I really try to do is make sure that I'm educated not just on the client, but on what their risk tolerance is and how important the particular issue is at hand. And then I try to put myself in their shoes and think about what is the kind of outcome they want and give them the right legal answer, but then talk about with them the different options and game things out and really try to do it from a business perspective and understand who my audience is and who they're answering to. And so usually I always have a conversation with them about what my gut is on something, not just from a legal perspective, but how to navigate potential business issues in the event that there's a problem that comes up.
David, in your article, you mentioned that the best storyteller typically wins in litigation. How do you distinguish between someone who is, you know, a good storyteller and a good writer and someone who's just sort of giving you a line to convince you that they're right or that they should earn your business? How do you distinguish between those two different characteristics?
My experience.
In other words, how's your bullshit meter?
Well, in the case that I was talking about in the article, I mean, I've written probably 15 to 18 appellate briefs in my career. I'm a decent writer, but this was a particularly complex case, and I've seen the writing of this particular attorney before, and he's a brilliant writer that's very interesting. You have to be very concise and direct and know how to address the issues that an appellate court understands. So I just, you know it when you read it,
yeah.
Right?
It's so important that you say, it's so, you know, interesting that you say that because I see a lot of writing too. We do a lot of appellate work and, you know, people think that you have to write a lot to be persuasive and sound like a lawyer. And the opposite is true. And judges will tell you this. I mean, I read a book by Scalia where he addresses this very thing. Like, don't have to sound like a lawyer, right, to be persuasive. And the creative part comes in where you can convince someone, either a client or a judge or opposing counsel, that you're right without going into a long diatribe. The more concise way to do it is shows your creativity and is much more persuasive.
If you can take a paragraph and say it in a sentence and the sentence just has punch, that's creativity.
Definitely.
I just have one question. Now, you both have been doing this a while. You're very successful. And I think creativity is more natural for the two of you now. It just kind of free flows. But what would the advice be for a younger attorney or a younger worker in any craft? How do you be more creative? How does that become a part of the game plan?
I think that's a great question. What I tell them to do is to watch other folks in action, to shadow people, to really just be aware not just of the client's business and their industry, but also to just pay attention to what's going on in the world and, you know, business world in particular. Read. just, you know, read about business, read about companies and understand, because you need to, and then you also need to be able to just separate yourself from the role that you're playing and put yourself in your client's shoes. I think that that's a critically important part of it too.
In the interest of time, I'll say ditto. I agree 100%.
All right.
Right answer for there the other half. For the other half of Inside Out.
Make sure you check it out. Create Creativity, the latest edition of Inside Out in the Chicago Lawyer Magazine. David Susser, why don't you hang around for the grab bag?
All right.
You are listening to Christina Martini on Legal Face-Off. Tina is a partner at McDermott, Will & Emery and focuses her practice on domestic and international trademark and copyright law, as well as domain name, internet, social media, advertising, and unfair competition law. Tina has received numerous professional accolades, including an AV preeminent rating by Martindale Hubbell and being selected for many years as one of America's leading intellectual property attorneys by various legal publications, including Chambers & Partners and World Trademark Review. Tina is also the recipient of the Anti-Defamation League's Women of Achievement Award and has been recognized by Crain's Chicago Business as one of Chicago's most influential minority lawyers. In addition to her full-time practice, Tina is an author, columnist, legal analyst, and podcast host, and she frequently shares her thought leadership with respect to current issues and trends impacting both the legal and business landscapes through various media outlets. McDermott, Will & Emery is an integrated international law firm. McDermott has an uncompromising commitment to legal excellence, extraordinary client service, and a high-performance culture. It is committed to helping clients achieve stellar legal and business results today and well into the future. To contact Tina and to learn more about McDermott, Will & Emery, visit MWE.com.
Legal grab bag time as we always close out the show on Legal Face-Off on WGN. Rich and Tina, Sam and Ben, David Susser, kind enough to stick around after Inside Out. You know him, you love him. And Stephen Carman joining us, the president of the SIU Resource Group. It is SIUResourceGroup.com. And also, you're a radio host of America's Most Notorious. We love that name, by the way. Welcome.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
Rich, why are the blinds closed, though? This is, I mean, I think we should take people behind the curtain here.
Given Steve's background, he's got a lot of people after him constantly.
So okay.
We're trying to keep his appearance under wraps, so to speak. But
first ever.
Lots of people after Carmen.
With the blinds closed. So,
absolutely.
Tina, we'll start with the Mexico shooter situation. Mexico wants a shooter. That's the headline right there.
Yeah, so we're all reeling from the mass shooting that happened last weekend in El Paso, Texas, where we had 22 victims that were massacred, eight of whom were Mexicans. There's been a lot of discussion over this past week about the alleged shooter, Patrick Crucius, and there's been a lot of discussion about what the U.S. and Mexican governments are likely to do in the wake of these horrific murders. Crucius allegedly drove 10 hours from his home in a Dallas suburb to El Paso to commit the shooting, which is a predominantly Hispanic city that we all know is close to the Mexican border. The shooting is viewed by many as an intentional attack against Mexicans, and investigators believe that he's the author of an online manifesto that criticizes what he termed the Hispanic invasion in Texas. Right now, there's speculation that the El Paso prosecutors may seek the death penalty and that there will be separate federal charges pursued alleging domestic terrorism. Since the shooting is also considered an act of terrorism under Mexican law, there's speculation that the Mexican government may seek extradition of Crucius. We recently saw the U.S. extradite El Chapo, but unlike that case, the Mexican government in this instance would be seeking to extradite a U.S. citizen to Mexico for acts that were committed in the U.S. So it's a little bit trickier in this situation, and international law prohibits two countries trying a suspect for the same crime. And so given that Mexico doesn't pursue the death penalty, it seems pretty unlikely that Mexico is going to be able to extradite him, but may nevertheless try to do so to make a statement about how horrific and terrible they think these acts were.
Yeah, it's really interesting. You know, the treaty is in place and both sides have the right to extradite, you know, on either way. And the United States has done it frequently for Mexico, but never vice versa. Mexico has never extradited someone from the U.S. to stand trial in Mexico, mostly because, you know, the U.S. has opposed that for a variety of reasons. You know, we believe in certain rights in this country that Mexico doesn't afford their litigants. On the other hand, as you mentioned, the United States has already said that they're going to pursue the death penalty in this case. Mexico doesn't have that. So I agree with you. I think that they are doing this mostly for show, mostly to stand up for, I think, the seven people who were murdered in this situation. But interesting legal theory to, you know, if they really pursue it, to determine whether they are successful in it. But guys, what do you think? Should Mexico have the right to make this person stand trial in Mexico? Steve, what do you think? Start with Steve.
Yeah, no, he should not be sent to Mexico. He should be prosecuted here. It does sound like a hate crime, but I would encourage everyone to get all the facts, as we've seen from investigations before we determine, you know, his total intent and scope. I can tell you, I spend a lot of time in Mexico working. I was just down there a couple weeks ago and read a lot of the press and in the paper, and they talked about the citizens there, you know, speaking up for what's important to them. And those words were the actual words they used several times.
Dave, how much do you think the politics of the situation has rolled into it? Obviously, you know, Mexico has been very sensitive to, you know, Trump's desire to build a wall and his recent statements, you know, calling some citizens of the United States vermin and saying they live in squalor. Many have interpreted these shootings as a direct result of how Trump has characterized some minorities, including Hispanics. Do you think Mexico is doing this to try to assert themselves in the face of this assault that many see as, you know, coming from the White House?
Yeah, I do. I think the political situation is very charged, and that's why Mexico is stepping up here. I think it is going to be a hard case to support extraditing Crucius to Mexico, and I'd actually say he ought to be tried here. He committed it here. He is a U.S. citizen. I think there's no doubt, though, that apparently from this manifesto, if that is his manifesto, it leaves no doubt that he was targeting Mexicans. You know, it says he was railing against a Hispanic invasion. So I think Mexico has to speak out and say, hey, we're interested. I think we ought to cooperate with them. I have to say, because each time I read about this, I have to scratch my head on it. He's railing against a Hispanic invasion. But, you know, Texas was part of Mexico for hundreds of years before it became part of the U.S. So, you know, he's attacking people who actually are native to that area.
Before we move on, I mean, we just heard from a guest talking about these shootings and efforts to, you know, remedy them. Do you guys think this is going to be solved with legislation? Do you think it'll be solved? I mean, how do you think these shootings will get fixed? I mean, do you agree with what the legislator said about some of these laws being effective? Just generally, obviously, they're terrible. Any thoughts?
Yeah, I think it's an incredibly complex situation. I think we ought to pass the legislation. I think right now what's driving a lot of these mass shootings is the political rhetoric coming out of the White House. That's going to be one salve, but I think a real resolution is far more complicated.
After tons of celebrity support, as we move on in the legal grab bag here, Santoya Brown has been released from prison. And Tina, a lot of heavy hitters on this list of celebs, right?
Yeah, so we've had discussions about this story previously on our show. We've had Kim Kardashian West, Rihanna, Snoop Dogg, and LeBron James, just among a few of the many folks who have lent their support to Santoya Brown, who recently had been serving a life sentence in a Tennessee prison. She was convicted in 2006. She had killed a man. She shot him point blank in the back of the head when he had picked her up at a drive-in restaurant in Nashville. And he had picked her up for sex. She was the victim of sex trafficking starting when she was a teenager. Her lawyers had contended that because she was a victim of sex trafficking and lived in grave fear for her life, that was one of her defenses, as well as the fact that she was the daughter of a woman who had abused alcohol when she was pregnant. And so they claimed that she was not able to form the necessary intent to commit murder. Her original sentence had her eligible for parole after 51 years. She has served 15 years, and she's now out of prison, will remain on parole for 10 years. And the terms of her parole include that she must not violate any federal or state laws. She has to stay employed, and she must participate in regular counseling sessions. She seems to have taken steps to rebuild her life while in prison. She earned her GED. She completed university studies and is working on a book. And there will be a documentary about her that will come out later this year. But yeah, this one made the headlines for a while. So it'll be interesting to see what happens later this year when the documentary and her book come out.
David, thoughts on this? Is this an example of celebrities using their positions for good? On the other hand, think of how many other people, you know, are not getting the light of day because their case didn't warrant Snoop's attention.
I think this is an instance where celebrity voices certainly helped her. And I, from what I understand about this case, it's the right decision. I think the good news, I think, is that our society has become more sensitive in the last couple of years and more aware of the issues of sex trafficking and the abuse that happens. And the fact that this really is a legitimate argument for self-defense, even if it looks like an aggressive act, it's self-defense. And so I'm glad to see that society as a whole is recognizing it, and she got the benefit of it.
Rob Blagojevich is back on the Legal Grab Bag. It's been a long time since we've heard from the once tie-dyed man. Well, not tie-dyed. It was more like bowling ball black tie. But now they don't have any more hair dye. But he's been brought up recently by the president.
It's been way too long since we've mentioned Blago on our air. It's been at least
2 weeks.
It's 2 weeks. Yeah. Yesterday, Blago said Trump said he's strongly considering commuting the sentence of our former governor, who is now, of course, about halfway through a 14-year sentence. Trump said, I thought he was treated I guess I could do this in my Trump voice. Should I do my Trump voice?
Sure.
I thought he was treated unbelievably unfairly. That's terrible. He was given close to 18.
It's the facial expressions, listeners.
close to 18 years in prison. He said, I'm thinking about commuting his sentence. And he blamed it on the Comey gang and all these sleaze bags, as Trump called it. So listen, many are saying that this is just Trump's way of deflecting attention from the current news of the day, which is focused on his handling of the shootings in El Paso and Toledo, mm-hmm. as he called it, not Dayton.
Oh, God.
Trump said it was Toledo. Yeah, so many are saying this is just his way of deflecting attention. But, you know, I've said many times on the show, I think 14 years was ridiculous. Trump said that, all he did was have a phone call. Remember, Blago was on Celebrity Apprentice, hosted by Trump way back in the day. And the interesting thing, in addition to all that, I think is, you know, remember, Trump said he's coming to Washington to drain the swamp and to get rid of all this insider, you know, trading and all this insider discussion. Yet he is willing to commute the sentence of someone who's the most high profile example of someone, you know, being convicted for corruption. So we'll see what happens. Guys, what do you all think? Will Blago get the Trump call?
I'll believe it when I see it. I mean, I think we covered this story the last time that he did this, which was, 8 months ago, 12 months ago? I agree with you, Rich, that this is just an attempt to deflect whatever faux pas he's committed, the daily faux pas. In this instance, it's the unfortunate and horrific shootings that happened last weekend that, you know, he's juxtaposing this messaging about Blagojevich with that, which I just think is completely wrong. But I'll believe it when I see it.
Well, remember, Blago was impeached and removed from office. So now we have someone who's the most high profile example of potential impeachment, as we just discussed with the congressman, maybe commuting the sentence of a governor who was impeached. What are your thoughts on this?
Yeah, I am not a fan of generally of going through and retrying cases and handing out new sentences and somehow justifying them. You know, you can see it in the Santoya Brown case, obviously. I agree with that. This case, though, I mean, you can argue it should have been a few more years or a few more less years, but Blago got what he got, and, you know, he got that through the system, and he should serve time.
Susser, weigh in.
Yeah,
Blago, in or out?
Well, I'd be surprised if Trump carries through. I'm kind of with you, Rich, that I think the sentence was overly harsh when it was handed down, but I think he deserved the conviction that he got.
Now might be a good time to remind our listeners of my visit with Blago behind bars. Did I ever tell you this story? Tina's heard it, but I'll make it quick. A year into his sentence, one of my associates had been working on his criminal defense team before he joined our firm. And he came to me and said, I want to go visit Blago in prison. I'm like, Yeah, let's go. I'm all in. So we went to Denver, and we visited him in federal prison. Again, this was about a year in. And we walk in, and it's just like you see in the movies. You go through the whole, you know, screening and security. And into the lunchroom, just alone, in walks Blago. And he has a discussion with my associate, who he knew again very well. And then it's just me and Blago talking for a while. And the number one question everyone asked me, what do you think it was afterwards?
What color was his hair?
Exactly. The funny thing is, at that time, it was a year in, it was a mystery. It was later they released that picture of him with, like, silver hair, which is what he had at the time because they don't allow hair dye. But that's the one thing I swore not to tell, and I kept that promise until the picture was released.
By the way, I do have a quote from Trump on this. I thought he was treated unbelievably fairly. He was given close to 18 years in prison. He was actually sentenced to 14 years in prison. So 14.
Toledo, Dayton, 14, 18,
14,
whatever.
15, 16.
You're only the president.
17, 18.
Were you able to do Facebook Live? I know they don't allow hair dye, but could you Facebook
not
Live?
Not in prison. No. We did take a great selfie, though.
I'm picturing them just seizing all of your property. Yeah. That's amazing. So another law firm that's very big is getting even bigger, Rich. This one is Denton's. The title is Massive Law Firm to Become Even More Massiver. I didn't even know massiver was a word.
It's not.
Yeah. So okay. Tina, you work for a big firm. David, you hire firms big and small. This one is getting massiver, as Sam said. It's only been around for 7 years, the current intonation of intonation? No. Is that a word?
It's the wrong word, but it is a word.
The current Denton has only been around for 7 years. They started with 2,500 lawyers, and now they're at over 10,000 lawyers around the world with this new merger with Lee International. Huge, getting bigger. So what are your thoughts? I mean, Tina, you, again, are at a very big firm.
Yes.
What is the culture like, you think, at a firm with 10,000 people? Is it possible to, you know, get through, get things done? I mean, there's got to be huge bureaucracy involved with 10,000 lawyers. I'm only at a firm with 30 lawyers.
So it's interesting. Let's all remember that Denton's used to be Sun and Shine way back in the day. And so a very different firm, very strong culture. I think when you start getting, and I am at a firm right now that's about 1,200 lawyers. And I think that, and one of the reasons why I went to it is because it does have a very strong collaborative, collegial culture. I do think, though, just based on my prior experience, that when you start getting north of 2,000-3,000 lawyers, depending on how you grow, it can very well impact the culture. I can tell you that conflicts are probably the number one concern. I don't even know how you navigate a 10,000 person firm without
imagine
having
that CC list. Imagine that reply all situation.
Yeah. What if you send
breaks the
wrong
internet.
What if you use the wrong email list, you know, and then right. You just send something to 10,000 people?
All right, Sussler, you hire outside counsel all the time. What do you look for? I mean, without going down the whole rabbit hole of what exactly you look for, would you ever hire, and not to disparage Denton's great firm, what is your sort of, you know, wheelhouse for hiring outside counsel? Do numbers matter? Do you look at how many attorneys they have?
Sort of. It depends on the matter. But I have to say 10,000 lawyers under a single name, I wouldn't touch it because there's no, it's a Swiss Verein, meaning it's a bunch of.
That's a real world.
Swiss Verein, meaning the individual countries are separate profit centers. So you're really, in essence, licensing the name. There's no real quality control. Sun and Shine, Nath and Rosenthal, the old Chicago firm, was an outstanding firm. But now, to me, it's gone. I wouldn't know what to do at the 10,000 lawyer firm. I just don't think you have quality control.
Steve, you hire outside counsel as well in your other capacity, among your many roles. What are your thoughts? Would you ever consider a firm that size? What's your sort of wheelhouse in terms of hiring outside counsel?
You know, I always hire by the person, and that may surprise people, but it could be the biggest or smallest firm. And if they're competent and I like them and we get along, that's really what I'm looking at. I got to tell you, when I saw that story, I mean, I love attorneys, right? They're my friends, but they're A-type personalities. And to get that many to agree to go in one direction is incredible. So,
you know, you're surrounded by lawyers in this room.
Yes,
right?
I'm in trouble.
Tina, are you guys in South Korea yet?
We were. Yes. Not
Tina anymore. Tina went along with Trump on the recent visit to North Korea.
Oh, yeah.
I saw you.
Yeah, with Dennis Rodman.
Were you in the DMZ? Wait, how many, for those that don't know, me, How many lawyers does the average firm have? Is there a figure on that? I mean, you said yours has 30. Some have thousands. I mean, do we have a guess?
I think most law firms across the country are relatively small. You know, less than 100?
Less than 100.
Less than 100.
Okay. So to have 10,000 lawyers at one firm,
that's unique.
That is unique for sure. All right, let's talk students for Trump. Keep the Trump trend going.
Yes. So John Lambert, who was one of the founders of Students for Trump back in 2015, has pled guilty to wire fraud conspiracy. He apparently admitted to running a scam where he pretended to be a lawyer and took money for rendering legal advice. So Lambert originally made headlines as a leader of Students for Trump during the presidential campaign. He was known for his media appearances, and he and his co-founder would be seen with their Make America Great Again hats and women in bikinis, and they did a lot of tweeting. So apparently Lambert's latest antics are he set up and ran a fake law firm called Polk & Dunn between 2016 and 2018. He claimed he was an NYU law school graduate with and had a finance degree from Penn. He claimed that he had 15 years of experience practicing in corporate and patent law. He apparently swindled at least half a dozen people who paid him for legal advice across a bunch of different practice areas. And under his plea deal, he's got to forfeit the $50,000 that he earned from his fraudulent activities. And he is going to be sentenced on November 18. So
everyone wants to be a lawyer is the takeaway here. Don't go through the, law school detail and nitpicking of
it
actually getting
like there's
a
so many of
license.
These people who just, you know, not only do they fake that they're a lawyer, but they like, you know, fake that they're this amazing lawyer who went to an amazing law school and they open up these fake law firms.
Pope
it's
and
crazy.
Dunn.
Not to be confused with Pope and John. Do we all remember that old law firm? It was a great firm.
Merged into Denton's, maybe.
Yeah.
YouTube is getting more and more ridiculous as the days go on. And now we're looking at an investigation involving animal cruelty. Rich, people think they can just post whatever they want on YouTube.
Man, it just reminds me of why I hate YouTubers. A lot of them are idiots. My son is obsessed with YouTubers. He wants to be a YouTuber. He, in fact, has his own YouTube channel. He's 9.
Does he use TikTok?
He does. My daughter does, I think. I'm still not sure what TikTok is. But
I have no idea. What can you fill us in?
It's a thing.
Yeah,
you
so
use
my
videos?
Niece?
It's
no, like I don't
are
personally.
Are you a TikToker?
It's Snapchat for videos, I think, right?
Yeah,
basically?
Yeah, essentially. Mm. So like my niece sits there and she creates these like music videos and she goes to different parts of the house. She does them with her friends. She goes to the backyard and she creates these music videos and then they share them among groups. And so it's huge. It's a very hot thing among, she's like 11. So,
the key is that it disappears, which, you know, is.
Does
but
it though?
She stores it. I mean, yeah. she's shown us videos that she's done weeks and months ago. So I think the sharing ends up disappearing, but she's got a little like log of them.
All right. So. Well, Steve, this woman might classify as one of America's most notorious because she is, as Sam mentioned, being investigated by the LAPD for animal cruelty because she posted the video and I saw the video and she strikes her dog in the face at one point, and then a few seconds later, she like spits on the dog.
Here's the full list.
And then
she pranks her pup using cling wrap, spitting, shoving, slapping, striking the dog.
Right. And then she says, I want to clarify that I'm not a dog abuser or animal abuser in any way, shape, or form. Oh, really? It certainly looks that way. So she's being, of course, you know, attacked, which she should be online. She's got 300,000 subscribers. But like bigger picture is there, you know, it's just a function of where we are in terms of media that these people become stars and they have no concept of, you know, what they're doing frequently and no filter on what they do.
Yeah, you're exactly right. I can tell you just from as being an investigator, that's some of the first places I look. We've caught felonies on there. We've caught all types of crimes. And of course, you know, I'm honor bound to share those with the authorities. And an animal abuser is, you know, come on. She's that was horrible. She gets whatever punishment she deserves.
Yeah. Dave, proper use of the LAPD's resources here?
Yes. Throw a book at her.
Tina?
You know, what is wrong with her? What is wrong with people? That's all I can say.
Well, the issue is these people become famous, but we don't know anything about their character or their quality.
Yeah, they'll do anything to become famous,
because
so they'll abuse their
dog. Good looking or they're funny or XYZ, but we know nothing about them, and then they take their platform and do stupid stuff.
Well, to your point, it's a Tina's point. You know, she has actually gained followers since this video has been disclosed, so she has actually, you know, taken advantage, or she has profited from it, because she's got so many more followers and subscribers, and that's the name of the game, right? I mean, people pay, advertisers pay for subscribers, so unfortunate. I think she should be seen on video being abused by someone like she abused this poor animal.
Yeah, let's see how she feels then.
Yeah.
Last topic on the grab bag here. It's a verdict involving Katy Perry.
Sound effects time. You got any? Unlicensed Katy. There we go.
Is that the right one?
I was hoping for some of Katy Perry's unlicensed music.
I don't have any of that. Sorry.
Yeah, we covered it last time, and there is a verdict since our last show. Katy Perry was sued by another artist named
Flame.
Flame, right.
Thank you, David.
Yeah. Good
big Flame. Big good Flame fan.
Susser's all about Flame. They were alleging that she copied Dark Horse song, she copied some of Flame's music. And a jury agreed to the tune of $2.78 million. Her attorneys have, of course, said that this is a miscarriage of justice and said that there is no infringement. There was no access of substantial similarity. So big verdict. It seems like the trend is in these cases to find against the alleged infringer. We've talked a little bit about what effect this has on creativity and on music, and we all agree, as do most experts, that there is always some degree of similarity in especially music. The defendant's experts in this case said there are millions of songs that, you know, would qualify under this verdict, because the, you know, electronic beat at the beginning of both songs is so common that it really opens the door to so many lawsuits. So I think this will, again, lead to more litigation, and maybe that's a good thing. I don't know. This is your area, of course.
Well, it'll be interesting. I mean, I'm not a music copyright expert, but I can tell you that David and I had this conversation yesterday about, you know, we're talking about genres of music that are defined by certain things. And I think it's going to be very interesting to see what happens to this case on appeal, because unlike some other copyright cases we've seen in the music industry over the past few years, I'm not convinced that this one is as clear cut as some of maybe the other ones that we've seen in terms of the arguments regarding substantial similarity.
David, you, in addition to being a world-class attorney, are a musical expert. We all agree on that, right? Especially on the course of your appearances on Legal Faceoff, we've extensively covered your music knowledge. So what do you think on this and other similar cases?
Well, I did spend time listening to both Katy Perry's song.
You weren't hired as an expert. Let's disclose that, right?
Let's disclose. I'm not. And I'm not a Katy Perry fan. I don't know if I've ever listened to a Katy Perry song all the way through until last night.
But do you play her fan on TV?
But I play her fan on TV.
You were the left shark, weren't you?
Yes.
You were the shark. I knew it.
That's right. No, like you said earlier, Rich, I think it's an electronic beat that is the foundation of probably every popular song over the last 5 to 10 years, and you hear it in dance clubs wherever you go. You cannot say that this was stolen. I just have a hard time believing it. And the other thing is, you know, when you talk to rock and rollers, and I was thinking about this, like talk to Springsteen. Go back and listen to Springsteen's South by Southwest presentation several years ago, and he traces some of the intro to his song Badlands back to an old Animals song, and he tells you exactly how he stole it. Right. And all rock and rollers will tell you they borrow.
But Eric Burdon isn't, you know, going out and suing him.
Exactly. It's the sincerest form of flattery. It's not like Vanilla Ice and Under Pressure. That was pretty clear. That was clear cut.
Well, do you know the most cited allegation of Springsteen copying? Let's see if you know your Springsteen as well as I know you do.
I don't know what you're referring to.
So the song Outlaw Pete,
which
is about 10 years old, which is not one of his more, you know.
Was that from Magic?
I think it's on Magic.
No, that's Working on a Dream.
Oh, okay.
Outlaw Pete is one of those albums. Magic or Working on a Dream.
It's the first song of Magic.
And it sounds a lot like the Kiss song, I Was Made for Loving You.
I've never heard that album.
Which is a disco song.
And I've never heard that song.
Oh, if you play, when we're done, I'm going to play it for you. And it's very similar.
We could just sing it if you want.
I was made for
Oh, don't want to get sued.
I'm Outlaw Pete.
In a room full of lawyers.
Outlaw Pete is about a bandit in diapers.
Well, not listen. These two songs thematically are the same, Katy Perry, but the whole issue is, of course, how they sound. But
right.
I'll play it for you here in a moment. What do you think on this situation?
Well, I got to tell you, I'm not a Katy Perry fan. Ah. So, too, I did listen to the songs, though.
Should have had you on the jury.
So I was, I endured it twice. I do see, just as a layman, some similarity there. But I got to tell you, though, I'm a big creativity fan. And when you start reaching into that, you know, you can find similarities to a lot of actions in life. So I'm just not a fan of the verdict. I'm not.
Sam, you love Katy Perry.
Waking Up in Vegas. Favorite Katy Perry song. Do you have one?
Mine?
Yeah. You always ask us.
I really do like Hot and Cold.
Okay.
I like Firework. I love Teenage Dream. I'm a California Girls big fan.
I love what?
I've got California Girls.
Oh, no, before that. Teenage Dream.
Firework, Teenage Dream. Okay. I've got a 14-year-old girl. So, you know, the whole 10-year run of Katy Perry has been in my life. So
The California Girls I know isn't that Beach Boys remade by David Lee Roth?
Yes. This is not version, the first time Katy Perry's been accused.
Her version has a U in it, so it's a little different. And it has Snoop, of course, in the middle of it. So, yeah, love me some Katy Perry.
Ben said he thought that mine was I Kissed a Girl. That was not. It's up there. It's on the power rankings for sure. So that does it.
One
Steve Cartman and David Sussler, thanks for coming in on the Grab Bag. Ben, thanks to you. For Rich and Tina, my name is Sam. We'll talk to you next time on Legal Face Off.
It's Christina Martini and Rich Linkoff. You know what time it is. Welcome to Legal Face Off. Two lawyers trading jab for jab. So hit them up with any questions you have. WGN Radio, we blowing up your stereo. Got a question, just pick up the phone and they'll let you know. Covering sports, Hollywood, and don't forget the politics. It don't get no better than this, nah. Courtroom combat going hand to hand.